All right, hello everybody, and welcome to, I don't even know what episode we're up to, the Drexel podcast. I'm Nate, and I'm told it's episode 8, but I'm, it rhymes with Nate. We have Dan with me, and here's Eric. The fact that we're up to episode 8, I guess that's a good sign. We're having a good time, and none of us have died, and we made it through the big COVID wave. We'll see what happens with that, but because of that too, again, we have lots of basketball games to talk about, so we're just going to hop right into it. So we're both talking. I mean, we're all getting up in age, but thankfully our memories are good enough that we can remember a week ago when Drexel played James Madison, and we're going to knock them out kind of one at a time, go through each game, and then just kind of share our thoughts on what happened. So we'll get to it. So this was last Monday night. So Drexel hosted James Madison, and really, we were terrible in the first half, honestly. And right before halftime, James Madison led this game 28-16. So 16 points in the first half. We shot 25% and then 12% from three-point range. And then, James Madison ran a zone, which has been giving us some trouble in the last couple games. I know Delaware gave us some trouble with it. Nice to see us adjust into the second half. We seemed like we figured out putting one of our big men at the top of the key, and it seemed like it'd make a difference, and did a much better job distributing, getting the ball out to the perimeter for 3-point shots. Cam ended up having 22 of his 27 points in the second half. Mari Williams had a big second half, 9 second half points and 13 rebounds in only 23 minutes. It was nice to see us adjust well. Then I was shooting 67% in the second half and 60% from 3-point range. So I felt like it was nice to see us make an adjustment. I was thinking about this. We don't have many games this year where we come from behind or came from behind. I'd have to go back and look. We tend to lead and then give it away, or lead and hang on to it. But this is a game where we were behind, and then we started the second half with a 13-0 run, I think, right out of the chute, and got up by 12. So it was nice to see us kind of, win in a different way. So what did you guys see last Monday night? Any thoughts that you had about that game?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just real quick. It was JMU was playing 4 games in 8 days, similar to Drexel when they played Charleston. It was the third straight road game. They're coming off of an OT game with Hofstra 2 days before. It was really, cards were stacked up against them. You add to that the fact all the injuries they've taken, and the fact they're a pretty young team. That's a little bit, I think, overdone as an argument. Their minutes continuity, which is a stat that speaks towards the minutes last year, number of people who were playing last year versus the number of people who were playing this year, or minutes for people, the same people year over year, is right in line with Drexel's, actually. So they have the same kind of number of returning players as the Dragons have, which I think is a pretty high level. So all none of that's the point. The point is, bad spot for JMU, and I think Drexel took advantage of some tired legs, especially once JMU got off the lead. I think JMU slowed down once they got up big, and they were never able to get their legs back again. And I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, so JMU did a pretty good job, not known for the pressuring, but they did a pretty good job in the first half. But like you said, they played 4 games, 8 days. You can't press 40 minutes. Second half, they tried to press, but Drexel was able to break it. And they wore them down. You just second half, when you see a tired team, the second half is where you fall behind. It also was very interesting in that game. We see Cameron Winter going all season, or at least since Princeton, missing a free throw. Misses 2 free throws in that game. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit interesting. In the second half, Drexel had 56 points versus 16 in the first half. I don't think I've ever seen a team score 40 more points in one half than the other. A little crazy.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was like a 2-3 zone that JMU ran. And then, again, we put – I think at first it was Butler at the top of the key. And because the first half, we just passed around the perimeter like we didn't know what we were doing. And then the second half, we got it into the middle of the zone and kicked out a couple times for threes, and then – even again, Amari was able to get down low. So we did a much better job. I thought at the very end they pressed, and we did what we could to choke the lead away. They made some, I think they finished, they hit the last 5 threes or something. I don't know. I don't have that in front of me, but they made it interesting at the end, but no, it was nice to see us make an adjustment at halftime and really kind of take advantage. So it was, yeah, it's crazy the difference in the offensive numbers between the two halves. So, but yeah, any other, and you know, Coltrane Washington, you know, I know Dan, you've been really singing his praises, and he actually didn't have his best game, but yeah, I just have a note. He was, I look at plus minus, he was plus 14 in the game. So maybe a reflection of his defense, which, you know, we've been saying has kind of come along. So again, just a lot of good things, at least in the second half, to talk about there. So
yeah, Coltrane had 0 points in the game. That's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. I have a sermon to go on plus minus and use of that in games, because I just hate the stat. Mm-hmm. Long and short is, if you put me with LeBron and a couple other guys, my plus minus is going to look a lot better than if you put me with the two of you. You know, it's a small sample in games. There was a study done in the NBA, I want to say it was 5 to 10 years ago, and basically said that plus minus is something that stabilizes over about 30 games in the NBA season. So those are 48-minute games. Basically in college, by the time it's a usable statistic, the season's over. A lot of people like to use it. I'm not picking on you. I see it all the time. It's just one of those things that eats at me, because I think it's chronically misused. To your point, the team was better with Coltrane out there in this game.
I know there's games I look and I'm like, because that's the first year I'm really kind of looking at it, and because I use Stats Broadcast to look up, and it, you know, I'll see a guy, I'd be like, I thought he had a great game, and he's like minus 10. I'm like, oops. So yeah, it doesn't always fit, but the point being, again, I and we'll talk about him, especially related to last night. I agree with you. He's really made a lot of progress this year, I feel like.
Yeah, I'm excited to see him. The one thing I'm seeing, and again, it's one of those things I shouldn't be using the stat, but it feels like we're seeing a break between JB and Amari on plus minus routinely. And that's something I haven't had a chance to dig into yet, but it becomes a trend. You start getting concerned. Mm-hmm. But again, we're not there yet.
Yeah. So. All right. Anything else to add about that that win? I think that put us at 10-10. Should be a theme, saying 500. But anything else you guys saw Monday night you wanted to touch on?
I thought the theme for these games was crappy officiating in almost all of them. And that game had Nathan Farrell and Michael Luckey, so wasn't shocked that they kicked us off with a streak of miserable officiating. But glad to see those guys return to the deck again.
I guess after seeing that women's game, I forget who they played now, where they called everything a travel. Actually, I think that was a Delaware game, so that was a huge game, I think. I guess anything I've seen since then doesn't really match up to that. But either way, I think the outcome, I judge it too, but did it affect the outcome? And I think really the way we adjusted, I think, was really the big story for me anyway. So
I agree with you. And I don't think any of these games were affected by the officiating. I just think it's been lousy.
Yeah. So. All right, so that was Monday. So then Thursday, we hosted Hofstra, and we lost 83-73. I think this was a game I was pretty excited about. You know, I felt like, again, you team that you're just waiting for that sign of, okay, which way are we going to break? And you're crossing your fingers that we're going to break in the right direction. And at halftime, I mean, it was tied at 36. I mean, I personally felt you know, the whole game, though, that they were kind of in control and we were just kind of hanging on. So coming out of the second half is kind of what we ended up seeing then with Hofstra. So they outscored us 11-4 in the first 5 minutes, 11-4 in the first 5 minutes. And then around the 11-minute mark, they got up by double digits. And just we really could never really mount much of a run. Aaron Estrada really essentially did the same thing that he did up in Hempstead, 32 points, 14 of 21 shooting. You could almost run that play where you got that little screen and kind of on the wing there, right inside the 3-point line, got whatever jump shot he wanted and just burned us with that. He was 8 of 12 for the second half. And then Ray chipped in. He was 6 of 7 with 20 points. So those guys just flat out didn't miss. And you almost got the sense, I know there's some people who felt like we didn't have the best effort in that game. I could go either way on that. But you could almost sense we knew they were just going to come down and hit a jump shot. And no matter what we were going to do, you know, there really wasn't much we were going to do. But you know, a couple of bright spots. I mean, you know, Malik Martin had 14 points. Amari had We have 14 points or 19 points for the game, 14 in the second half. Another theme I see is guys will have one great half. It's like you can't get two great halves, and you don't really know what's going to come, let alone one game, one game to the next, even one half to the next. But the second half, we were 1 of 8 shooting. Free throw shooting has been a little bit of a problem in here lately. We're 10 of 16 from the free throw line. But the bottom line here, I have some stats. You look at the book, and it's like we only turn the ball over 6 times. Hofstra actually turned it over more, 15 times. We had a 19-10 advantage in fast break points, 42-22 advantage in points in the paint, and still really were never in the game because they just kept knocking down their jump shots. So what did you guys think about how that game turned out? Any thoughts? Eric, we'll start with you. You're ready.
I'm having a hard time believing Estrada missed 7 shots in that game. You know, every time I looked up, the guy was hitting. He was hitting these 3-pointers. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. He's a really good player. I thought it was Amari had a good all-around game. He got the 19 points, like you said. And he was pretty good underneath. You know, Hofstra doesn't really take it inside. Unfortunately, he's not as effective against a team that likes to shoot because, you can always shoot over a guy from 20 feet away. And the rebounds that when they do miss tend to be longer off 3-pointers. So, he didn't hit as many rebounds as he could have just because of, weren't as many rebounds available because they weren't missing. But also the long rebounds that come out of missing the shots. Butler, I thought, unfortunately, he was only 1 for 7. He just wasn't finishing around the rim. I just see injuries plaguing him. It has to be what it is. I think a guy, a 5-year guy is not going to have confidence issues. Unfortunately, I just think his back's really taking a toll on him. Because this is the kind of game where he could have really racked up some points if he was fully healthy.
Dan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you guys covered pretty well. I mean, Nate, I saw all those stats that you saw and kind of knew beat somebody in the paint like that and beat them in transition too. And, and still never, you're right, we never really felt like there was any kind of confidence, right? I mean, you got to credit Hofstra. There's nobody beating Hofstra when they play that well. I thought on the stat sheet, they probably did what the coaches circled and said, hey, if we do this, this, and this, and we win this game, they did those things. Mm-hmm. And they lost the game. So sometimes you got to tip your hat. That's what I'll do for Hofstra in this particular time. I will say, so much of this Drexel defense is predicated on closing at the 3-point line and giving up the mid-range shot. And that's an area where the Hofstra guards, especially Estrada, are very comfortable. I mean, Estrada's made his name all season long on the mid-range shot. Mm-hmm. So we may have to go back to the drawing board if we see them a third time and figure out, you don't want to zone them either. But, Estrada went 10 for 15 from 2, but you kind of live, I suppose, with that. But 4 of 6 from 3 is a killer, and you don't see that one coming. But he's up to 41% three in conference, too. So he's probably going to be the player of the year. It's not like it's a, terrible thing to give up a big game to him. But you got to – Jalen Wright, to me, was the one who killed us both times we played him, and he's the guy who – I want to say he's a 5th-year guy, and he's been around the block, and we should know better. And he's just executed at an elite level against us, too. So we've done a pretty good job on Cooks, really the rest of their team. Certainly beat him up in the front court. You expect to beat him up in the front court. Mm-hmm. But, the stars did what stars do. And our guys just, Cam, he was 6 of 14 from the field, 4 assists, 2 turnovers. It's very average, mm-hmm. Especially not for everybody, but for Cam. Right, and in a game where stars are going to have to take on stars, you can't have your stars just lose the battle that badly, and then that's what happened here.
Yeah, no, I think, and that was well. First of all, too, to give Hofstra credit, I mean, then they turned around and they looked like they did the same thing down at Delaware too, just kind of took it to them. So obviously, they're playing some good basketball now. But that, and we talked about this after the first game. As great a game as that was up there, it's like what could we have done to taken that mid-range jump shot away? And you're kind of saying, well, you give them the mid-range shot, but, man, when it's torching you and it's torched you twice, it's like, what can you do different? So we ran a 3-2 zone last night at Charleston, and it worked. We actually got a turnover out of it, but then, of course, we came out of it right away. But, that's my question. When you're playing a team that's clearly better than you are and doing something over and over again, what can Zach Spiker draw up to try to take it away? So I'd be curious if we see them again, what do we do different? Because it felt like we let them do the same. And yeah, Estrada's a great player. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, but you know, maybe you press them so you speed up their offense in the half court. You know, again, maybe, you know, I didn't play basketball, so I'm not as good X's and O's and whatnot, but a 2-1-2, I mean, something to put people in that spot so that he catches the ball and there's someone in his face. I don't know, because kept trying to man-to-man defense and he just torched it. So I don't know. We'll see what happens if we see him again. But yeah, any other thoughts on that game?
You know, really, if Drexel's not going to be the one that comes out of this, out of the tournament next month, I'd really like to see Hofstra come out. And I think they would represent the CAA well on a national stage. For one thing, I feel bad that they got screwed by COVID a couple years back. They win the conference but don't get to play. And secondly, their out-of-conference form was really good against good teams, beating Arkansas and taking Houston, who's top 10, I believe, taking them to overtime. So, you know, they, maybe Towson, would be the best representatives of the CAA.
Yeah.
No question in my mind, Eric. No question in my mind there. And I think Towson probably has a stronger profile right now, but I'd probably take Hofstra with their guards. I'd probably rather see Towson go just because Pat Scarry's been doing this a long time. But you know, Hofstra's guards are going to be tough in a tournament situation.
Yeah, and I kind of badmouth, is it Iola, their big man? Am I saying that right for Hofstra? But yeah, nice game. I mean, did he dominate the game? No, but, you know, 10 points, 10 rebounds. So I thought he played with a lot of enthusiasm. So, I mean, it wasn't totally worthless down there. He did enough. So, I mean, they get that plus the guard play. I agree. Good team. So,
and 2 rebounds for Mark Williams in that game. You got to do better than that in 26 minutes.
This is a good time for me.
A lot of missed shots.
The thing, I think he's really going to be a good player. He still has to polish a few things. I notice him a lot of times going for rebounds with one hand. Be strong, go with 2 hands, because I feel like he's missed a couple rebounds because of that. So, but, you know, thanks for
this is one of those things that you and I both see the same thing with our eyes, and I look, and he's first in the conference in defensive rebound percentage.
Like, well, yeah, then it's just an example of how much better he could be. You know what I mean? Because again, he grabbed that basketball, and I mean that's his. So anyway, yeah. So, guess what? Back to 500. So, Eric, you're gonna say something?
Yeah, it's Williams. I'll give him some kudos in that game on that fast break where he gets the block and then he runs and he got down court faster. Looked like John is getting down court there. He looked fantastic on that break. Like, what is this? Drexel in transition? We're one of the worst transition teams every year. But that one play, is, you know, he goes, it finishes up with a two-hand jam. And, like, man, that's what I want to see. They look fantastic. But, yeah, the transition game with Drexel on offense is just every year it's lacking.
I'll say this. It's definitely improved this year, the transition game, both ends, by the way, defensively especially, actually, probably with the exception of the Charleston game last night. We'll talk about that. Mm. But I think the transition play has been much, much better. Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of – so Saturday we played Northeastern, and I was – I actually thought we did a nice – I mean, we won the game 67-51. We were up 36-16 at halftime. We led by as many as 23 points in the first half. I mean, there was really never a point where this game was in question. I think – let's say Northeastern got within like 11 or 13 points, but really never took a serious run. They were 6 of 30 for 20% in the first half, 0 for 7 from three-point range. But then, yeah, fast break points, I had us up 12-0. I think part of, again, their missed shots, you know, you think of shot turnovers, and I thought we forced some turnovers too. It's a good time to play. All of a sudden, out of the last couple of games, Malik Martin, you know, able to force some steals and get out of transition. He had 3 steals in the game, so it's a little element to his game that we're seeing all of a sudden. But that helped us get some easy baskets and I think took some pressure off us too. So, but then, you know, Xavier Bell, who, and again, you talk about guys who were inconsistent, you know, had that dominating game in Hofstra up there, did really nothing down here, but then had a really nice game in 12 in the first half, 10 in the second half. So it was balanced and did a good job again getting in the paint. I think he's one of our key transition guys too when he's doing what he needs to do. I thought Okros had, you know, he was more active and he 2 for 3 from 3-point range, but then a nice drive, you know, so you want to see a little bit, you know, some different things in his game. And I thought he did a couple of nice things for us. But then you throw in Cam again, he didn't 3 for 10, but he didn't turn the ball over. So that was good. So it was nice to see other guys really chip in. And yeah, we just, and man, Northeastern, that's a shame how bad they are. I mean, they missed layups and they didn't defend, and it was a shame. So, but what do you guys think about Saturday?
I'd be perfectly honest with you, I didn't catch a ton of it, but it was nice to see the team get out to a lead and keep it and just roll somebody. Mm-hmm. It only made me question, how the hell did those guys beat Towson? and I just pull up the box score, and I'm seeing Towson with 1 for 15 from three that day, which is like Dan Crane or Gerald Cole's numbers. So, you know, I guess, you know, everybody's got an off day, and Northeastern took advantage. They had to win at some point, but they're just bad this year. Man, that's just it. They're just bad. They got some talent, actually. I like Shaq Waters. Joe goes a little legit. He played for Notre Dame, was good. Mm-hmm. They got some talent, just nothing's fitting together well at all.
Yeah, Malik Martin, to me, he's been in the second half of the season. I kind of saw this coming once he fit in with his team. He's been the most consistent player second half of the season. And I just look at these four games. He played, he contributed extensively on offense and defense in both games. David Bell, nice game, 22 points. I believe Drexel's had 8 different guys lead the team in scoring in given games this season. Every night, you just don't know who's going to be your leading scorer given another the next night.
Yeah, I think Malik is, you know, he's kind of that emotional leader type player. So, it's just been neat, that little extra element of, you know, he's forcing steals and he'll run the floor. I mean, he can handle the ball and he's fast. So he does a lot of good things, shoots the three, back him down. So, you know, again, but consistency, you want to see it game after game. So, blew him out. That's about it. Anything else you guys thought about?
I just want to jump on the Malik train and just say, I'm usually a 4-year guy. I like the guys who've been in the school for, or just at this point, 5 years, right? And the continuity of the program and everything else. But not only has Malik made me shut up about that, really, if you have a transfer that fits well, which is hard to do, but if you have a transfer that fits what you do, it really, he's been a huge piece for the team this year. And the coaches staff did a really, really great job getting him in the door. So obviously a local guy from New York, PA, but good to see him be able to move up a conference, be able, you know, to a higher level and be effective and find a good fit for him. I think this is going to help him in his career if he wants to continue with basketball. Just a lot of good stuff there. Really been impressive to me. And I like somebody actually who hasn't been in the system for 4 years. I'll get to this at some point, but I do feel like we have some guys who are a little stuck in the system. And he brings a little bit of that dynamic, sometimes too dynamic, but it's been more restrained in the second half of the season. I think he's been more effective, Eric, to your point. But, you know, he brings a little something different, a little flair to the offense that, you know, he can create a little bit, which is nice.
And that's the way the days are, the times are. You got over 700 guys transferring every year, most of them, you know, in their last season. That's two players per team. So you're going to – I mean, I guess Harry Brown's also – fourth, you know, in his last year, he came from JUCO, but that's normal, and that's you know, that's just the trend. Every team's got him, so if he can blend in, that's really going to be a plus. And it kind of took the sting. I mean, Bickerstaff, obviously the younger player, potentially the better player, sort of took the sting away from losing Bickerstaff.
I'm not ready to consider my position outdated, and people have been telling me this for years, but I'm ready to make it official. You bring in the transfers, let's go.
College sports free agency, and you hear about with football, it's hard to follow, but yeah, I mean, but you know, just another thing too, as you're talking about, Malik is that kind of guy. You know, you're looking, I guess I'm at the stage now, because it's, you know, we're only what, like 2 weeks left in the regular season. I mean, it's hard to believe, and you're looking for hope for the tournament at this point. And I just kind of picturing him as a guy that could, he's not going to want to lose down there. He's that type of player. So be curious if he could just kind of go off down there and carry us, because that's what we need too, as a guy night after night, like you said, you know, if not our leading scorer, one of our leading scorers, and he's that type of player, I feel like.
Yeah, I want him to, you know, go alone in a room with Cam Winter before the first game of the tournament, right, and kind of get in his face a little bit.
That's kind of exactly what I was thinking, yeah, as you were saying that. So, but anyway, so win a game, so if you're doing the math at home, it's pretty easy. You know that whatever we did the game before, we're going to do the opposite the next game. So so we went down to Charleston last night. So the one that's freshest in our memories. That's why I have the most notes. So we lost 79-75. So got out to a really good start. Led 13-4 with about 15 seconds left to, or 15 minutes to go in the first half. And then really the decisive part of the game was really towards the end of the first half when Charleston went on a 17-0 run and ended up being up 13 points with about a minute left in the half. So, you know, you look at the stat sheet too on this. I mean, relatively even in a lot of areas. You know, like turnovers were 12-11. Both teams shot 49%. You know, Charleston really just dominated us on offensive rebounds. But then again, second chance points really were pretty even, so it didn't hurt us too much. But bench points, actually, they were up 37-14, so that was a big difference in the game. And then it was one of those games too. I mean, in and out score us with second chance points, but I felt like they out hustled us in a lot of situations, and that's where offensive rebounds come in. But you know, the thing I liked last night is, and the reason we got back into the game is we realized Coltrane Washington was on fire, and we got him the ball. So I think that's one of our problems too with our consistency is we don't always recognize the guy that's got the hot hand, or, you know, go into the game saying this is the guy we want to be the hot hand and feed him the ball. But you could tell I felt like we were really looking for him and he had the green light. So, you know, had a great game. I'm going to ignore the, you know, missing the, you know, had a chance to tie the game with three free throws and missed the first one. Because I thought he did enough to get us back into the game. But then again, free throw shooting's been a little bit of a problem here. We were 7 of 12 from the line. But yeah, at least give him credit. I was just happy we found something and we went to it and we stuck with it. And that was just nice to see. But you know, again, Malik had a nice game, 12 points, 10 rebounds, and 3 steals again. Maybe we'll go into this a little bit more in depth in a little bit, but you know, Butler only had 2 points. Cam finished with 13 points, but was 1 for 6 in the first half. So again, even going back to the game when he had 27 points, which one was that? James Madison. I mean, he did nothing in the first half and had a dominant second half. So, I mean, that happens. But, you know, again, I was watching that second half and I was like, is this going to be the game that Cam just totally takes over and takes us to a win? And had a better second half, but it really wasn't. Didn't turn out that way. So, again, you know, back to 500. Can't put a couple games together in a row, and here we are. So, what do you guys think about last night?
Yeah, I mean, I think you had it right. I mean, I think it helps when your hot hand can shoot the ball at the half court. It's very hard to defend Coltrane when he's shooting, you know, 45 footers out there or whatever it was. I mean, so. It was an impressive performance by Train. It's what we've been waiting for him or Matei, right? And it's good to see him embrace the opportunity. He'd been cold for a few games, and you let shooters shoot, right? And to the credit of the coaching staff, they rode the hot hand in this game, and it gave him opportunities to continue to do it even after he had a few cold games. I think it's interesting. Makruska's was 13 minutes, and yeah, obviously they play the same role in the offense and whatnot. But we've got really two starters from the beginning of the year who've lost their job due to injury at this point, and been outplayed by the bench player. And it causes a lot of questions in my mind as far as why were these guys on the bench? If these guys hadn't been hurt, would they be playing? Are they really the more effective player? Are we just rolling with who's out there or what we see? You know, kind of. I'm sure. We don't see the practices, and there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that we don't know and understand. There's a lot of black box stuff going on. But it's a fascinating mental exercise for me to try to figure out what's going on here and why these guys, are being so easily replaced in some ways and aren't getting the minutes. So I thought it actually was a game that spoke to having Butler out there. It was a hustle game. It was a rebounding game. It was a missed shots game. He wasn't particularly effective while he was out there. He was 13 minutes. And I'm looking here, he didn't have a rebound in 13 minutes. So that's a problem. Amari had a better game, but really looked poor on offense, I thought.
Yeah.
He continues to struggle from the line. So we got to figure out something there because this is the perceived strength of this team, right? This five position, this duo that we have, the five, and he went to a place where they're not – I mean, they've got some size. Smart is a 6'8 senior. I mean, so he's been around and he's talented, but you kind of expect to have – an advantage in the front court here, and a pretty sizable one, and I don't think it really showed through. And then I think it was our fourth game in 8 days, so we opened this talking about JMU, and I'll close it talking about us. Fourth game in 8 days, short turnaround flight. They had also played Charleston, had played actually a tough game at UNCW, and probably, you know, had a tougher bus ride than we had a flight going home, coming back home. So I think that offsets a little bit. But at the end of the day, this particularly frustrates me because it came down to a close and late execution situation, and we failed to execute. I thought the final play was Cam Winter being way too cute for 20 seconds, to be honest with you. You know, it was a three-point game. Either get the quick two or he wanted to make the pass. He desperately wanted to make the pass and set something up for three. He had eight assists in that game. He'd been doing it successfully during the game. But, you know, everybody on Charleston was guarding three. They knew what was coming. And there's 20 seconds on the clock. They weren't shooting foul shots particularly well. There was no reason to stress. I thought we panicked a little early again. So disappointing because it does feel like a team that can't quite make that step forward, make that next step. And this was an opportunity to do it. You talk about the Hof dream was an opportunity to do it. This was another opportunity to do it. Short rest road game that looks like a tight spot, tough spot. And you can come out and execute late and win it, even though you're down 10 with a minute and a half to go. And stuck their foot in the bucket again. So frustrating to watch from my perspective.
Yeah, you know, looking here, you know, you had 27 million minutes for Amari Williams and 13 for Butler. And I think that based on Butler's health and the way Williams has been playing, that's probably a good 2-to-1 ratio. Something I like to see. I'm not sure about Okrus, about what his injury status is. I was kind of surprised that 2-to-1 ratio minutes for Washington versus Okrus has been going on as long as it. I mean, this is Washington's best game. There's some games he goes out there and does, you know, score zero, and his defense is nothing spectacular. I think Okrus's defense has picked up in this season. So, you know, maybe it's injuries. I don't know, but I would like to see those minutes kind of even out a little bit. It doesn't matter to me who starts. It's the amount of minutes that you play in the end.
Yeah, Dan, you were talking about it and I don't know if this is a conversation or, well, you know, you said, you know, games where you're looking like to take a step forward. And I was reading that Alan Boston, his preview of the game, and, you know, he made a comment. You know, I think the only hiccups they really had was losing to William and Mary, and I forget what the other game he mentioned. You know, I thought his spin on the team was a little bit too rosy. Like, I want to be optimistic, but, like, you know, even though we may not have the really kind of scary blemishes, we don't have that, like, really win that you just kind of say, wow, you know, here we go. You know, and then, yeah, I think, yeah, Hofstra was that chance and Charleston was that, and we didn't get it done, so. Here we are, 500. So we're fifth. The good part is, and you look at the standings, I was seeing it right. We're 7-7. So is Charleston. They're 500 too, but they're 6-6. We have three games on William and Mary, who would be, you know, basically want to avoid that play-in game. So we actually have, I think, a three-game cushion on that. So we're actually, if we beat William and Mary on Thursday, you know, add that on there. So we're going to avoid that game, but you're looking for reasons to believe that we can turn it around and.
Well, here's all you need to know. Drexel's played 24 games this year. Drexel's 12-12. Drexel's never been more than one game over 500 or one game under 500 all season. You mean you could sit there with a coin, flip coins all day. It's 50-50. You just can't. That's such a mathematical anomaly. But that kind of just shows how average this team's been this year.
We'll go to any other thoughts on the game itself.
I think the two big games, believe it or not, are the Elon and William & Mary game, because those are the, you know, look, finish top six. Don't be in the bottom four. Don't be in the play-in. Elon's a team that could potentially overtake them, or, you know, William & Mary is really a long shot. Mm. But those are two games you expect to win. And you look, Elon, they beat them by 28 up here. They got a big revenge factor going on there, and it's just the way this league goes. You never know what's going to come out on a given night. I mean, Drexel would probably be favored, but I'm not counting my chickens on that game whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're good with the Charleston game at this point. But to piggyback off of what you're saying, Eric, you have, and we've seen this. It's not unusual for these teams. You come off a win, and the next game's a little harder to be. You know, you're excited, and maybe you come out a little soft in the next game. You come out of a loss, and you come out a little angry. And this team especially, which kind of needs some anchor, right? We talk a lot. We've spoken ad nauseum about kind of it resembling its coach. I think it does. I think it's really ringing true at this point, which is it's calm, it's collected. None of these are bad things, right? This is how you grow a program. right? This is why the program is a lot better now than it was 5 years ago. So it's not like from a long-term perspective, especially in the world of transfers, where, you know, getting a kid's face means he may decide he wants to walk out the door. It's not a bad thing to be calm, cool, and collected. But on game days, right, you'd like to see a little more fight, especially coming off of wins. And I do think we're a little soft sometimes. Charleston, again, four-game and four-day spot. The 2-2 that we're talking about here, nobody was beating Hofstra that day. And Charleston was a tough spot game. So I don't think there's shame in either loss necessarily, but you're a better team than Charleston is. You're a better team than Charleston is, talent-wise, and as far as how long they've been together and everything else about this. So I'm still disappointed by that game. But, yeah, you do see they're better coming off of losses and worse coming off of wins. It's very clear. And they've got to find a way to kind of get that fighting personality out there. And I think Nate's right. I think Malik Martin is a key here. I think he could be an absolute key here. We have a lot of gentlemen on this team, which is not a good problem to have, generally speaking. But, you know, when it comes tourney time, I think that's what's leading to this kind of up and down. And schedule feeds into it, too. But, you know, it just so happens that the games are kind of laid out where most of these games we were likely to win or lose that way, too. But, yeah, it's I think there's something to it, Eric. I think you're right.
It's a conversation to have, and you know, I always end up siding on it's both. But, you know, are we inconsistent because, you know, we're not as talented as we think we are, even though you know, Coltrane had 21, Malik's had 30 points in a game, Cam scored 27 this week, Amari has, you know, lit people up this year. I mean, the list goes on. Are we not as talented as we think? So it's the players that are inconsistent, or, you know, and I'm thinking, or is – as our coaching staff not doing as good a job of getting, you know, like you think, like I said, I would just thrill to see Coltrane get the ball knowing he was hitting shots. And I'm thinking of Charleston too at the end of the game last night. I mean, they needed scores. They needed buckets down the stretch to fend us off. So who do they go to? They go to Meeks. They get a good matchup with him. They get his shot in the paint and, you know, got him the looks he needed to put the game away. So, I mean, ultimately it's, you probably say it's both, but I mean, is there a fault laying on one? Are we not as good as we think we are talent-wise, or do you think we could do better putting these guys in good positions?
Well, what do we base it on? So we look at last season, the team won the tournament, went to the NCAA tournament for the first time in 25 years. Also, it was a season where Drexel played just about every game on the road. So look at the record. They weren't bad. But the COVID, it's just hard to say. Then you try to project last season onto this season. You lose Bickerstaff, but you pick up Malik Martin. You lose Walton. Other guys are stepping up. So I think talent-wise, you're probably a little bit ahead of last year, but the rest of the league got better as well. So yeah, usually as fans, we will overrate our talent. That's what we do. I don't think the coaching staff's done one of them too many games, put it to you that way. I think I've seen opponents lose games, like the Towson game. But yeah, it's probably a judgment of talent. We get guys who have some really good games and they go out and do nothing the next game.
I think something I've been thinking about a lot recently is that we have guys, a couple of guys who are really talented, but their ceilings are not as high because of the talent as we thought they were. Keep in mind, this team hasn't played strong out-of-conference schedules in years. You know, Spiker really has not scheduled particularly well in the out-of-conference, in my opinion. Or not that he's scheduled poorly, but he hasn't scheduled top teams. I think the NCAA tournament exposed that a little bit, but I think Cam Winter and James Butler are guys who could run circles around people at this level. But they're not, to me, I don't know, you guys could tell me where you rank Cam amongst our former point guards, but I'd probably take Franz. You know, and I don't know that they're guys who are playing, you know, top 50 in the country basketball. JB, especially size-wise, he's limited a little bit, you know, when he's playing with the trees. We've seen that, you know, Rutgers over the past and some other play, you know, and in the tournament last year. I think you guys were talented for this level, but they hit their ceiling a little bit just based off of who they are, their size and their speed. I mean, nothing that's not about skill. They're very skilled players, but they have that. So I think, and when I see guys like Amari come in, or to a lesser extent, maybe an Xavier Bell, I see a guy who's capable. I mean, Amari Williams is capable of being like a guy who could bring you to that level, right? In some ways, it's reminded me of the freshman class, but I see guys who come in the door who can you can take this program up another step. Don't take for granted what we had in JB and Cam, because the cover's going to be awfully bare once the senior class leaves. But the guys who we have, I think the underclassmen right now, with the exception of the freshman class, which may or may not exist, I think are guys who have higher ceilings, is what I would say. So, like, talent's tricky like that. I think, it's a lot of it's opponent based, what we think of as talent. But I want to see better. I think they're better than they are more capable of than 500 in this league. They're defending champions. The league has gotten better. The league's got 10 good coaches and just pretty good odds that at least 9 of them come back next year, if not all 10. So I don't have any one coach I think is going to leave. I just think that certainly at least 9 will. So it's a good league that's getting better. And that's what's kind of scary. And then we're adding King Rice, who's an elite coach for Monmouth, and Stony Brook, who's been a very good team recently. So it's going to be a better and better league. And we can't, Zach Sparker came in here for like 3 years. We were like 250 in KenPom, 251, I think, back-to-back-to-back years, something like that. We can't get here to 150, which is what we were last year and about what we are this year. 146, I want to say, is the high this year. We bumped that 2 or 3 times. We can't get past. We get up there and then we play down a game because we do the zigzag, right? We win a game that, pushes us up, and then we lose the next game. So we just can't keep the bus through this 150-ish spot, which is exactly where we ended last year. We ended last season at 145. So going into the Illinois game. So you got to see year-over-year progress. We're not seeing it. You've got to, and with the team that is this senior-laden and is the defending champion, I think that's where the frustration comes from. It's less about talent so much as this is exactly where you were this year, and you've got a ton of seniors. This is your window, and you're losing. And that's frustrating to watch.
And I think, you hit on, I think we did talk before, it's like, with COVID last year, you didn't really get to see much of this team. And, now we're seeing it night in and night out. And, I think, maybe unfair to Cam and James, the hype that was surrounding them, coming off last year, like you said too, I'm thinking about, you talk about the progression of the type of player that Zach Spiker is bringing in, which I think has been his maybe biggest accomplishment. And I'm thinking Kirkley, I finally thought of his name. So you think of him as kind of the original, and the guy found a way to score, 30 points in a couple games, but you knew he's not a Division I body, but he tided us over. And now, you take the progression, and I can't remember who was in between. Well, we got transfers and guys, like you said, with the transfer era with bad attitudes. And is Harper, right? I couldn't stand watching that guy play. But now you bring in Cam Winter, but now behind him, I think Xavier Bell, maybe has, a little higher ceiling. And Odin, by the way, we even talked about, he was a starter at one point and now hardly plays. So you kind of wonder what's up there. So yeah, that's another challenge for the seniors now, as they got guys behind them who are probably going to take us the next step. And it's kind of adjusting your eyesight to, and you're like, wow, these are first team players, but they're maybe the guys behind them have a better ceiling. So, because my other point too on that is like, you'd expect these guys to be your sort of consistency, your kind of steadying force through your seniors. But now you feel like, again, maybe the expectations unfairly for them, was a little bit higher than maybe it should have been. But they still have time to turn it around, and we'll see what happens here in the next couple of weeks. So.
Can we, before we roll to the women, can I roll 2 quick points?
Yeah, I'm going to make one more too, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So Zach Spiker keeps thumping for it every time I see him, but Amari Williams is now number one in the conference in block shots, number one in defensive rebounding percentage. If this guy is an defensive player of the year, I'm going to get very upset with.
And also add too, there are some defensive plays that I feel like, why isn't he going there and swatting that guy? So believe me, he's a hell of a player now, but again, you see there's still a lot that he can improve on. And again, that's unfair to Butler too, because you see what Amari is capable of. But yeah, I agree.
Raw. He's still raw. You saw it in his offensive game against Charleston. He left points on the board, and he left some rebounds and some blocks out there. One ball just go right by him, which drove me nuts on a rebound. But this is the unfinished product, and he's your defensive player of the year going away, I think.
Yeah.
So that's really something. I'm going to let you make your one point while I remember what the hell it was going to be for me.
I was afraid I was going to do that to you. I'm sorry. Right. But yeah, no, well, in the Cam point, again, you know, and I agree with you too on he's a guy too. You just want to see get pissed off. You know what I mean? And I guess it's just not his personality. But, you know, again, you think of great guards. I agree with you. And this is not a knock on him, but I'd take him. I'd take Bashir Mason. Because those are guys that I can think of games like Bashir. I want to say Villanova and Syracuse come to mind, where he felt like he just took the team on his shoulders. And Cam doesn't have, I feel like, that signature game where you think of, like, you know, Cam took the team on his shoulders and won the game. I'm still waiting for that. There's time for it. But as far as Butler goes, you know, I don't know if it's injury, you know, or like Eric, you said, his back, or, you know, there's all this talk going into this season about his jump shot and how he really worked on his mid-range game. And, you know, I don't want to see that. You know, you're a big man. You know, I feel like – and he's been back, and I feel like they've gotten him to the post a couple times the last few games. And then he passes out of it, you know. Like, I want to see him down low, because then if there's a missed shot, he can get the rebound, like, use his strengths. So I don't know, again, how much of it is injury, or did we kind of his approach to the season wasn't quite what it should have been. I don't know. What do you guys think?
He kind of reminds me of Joel Embiid when Embiid's not healthy. What does he do? He hangs out at the top, doesn't stay underneath, doesn't want to mix it up. And you're right. I don't want to. If he's wide open and he's square to the net, 12-15 footer, he can hit those. But he's doing this fadeaway nonsense. And you know, you're fading away. You're not in our area position to get a rebound because you're too far away and you're fading away. Who's getting the rebound? You got four guards out there. That's not your best use. You need to get that ball out to your perimeter players, and you need to get under that net because that's where you make your money.
I also want to go back and watch the St. Joe's game, because we were sitting there, and I said to Evan during the game when we finally was like, okay, we're going to win, beat Northeastern, which I guess is right off the bat. But I said to Evan, I'm like, this might actually be the first game we've seen us win all year. And then Evan's like, no, we won the St. Joe's game. I'm like, you're right. And you think that was the game Cam and Butler really had great games. So, and I remember we scored it right at the end. I think the game-winning shot was like a pass from Cam to James and laid it in. So where has that gone? You know, what's changed? And is it injury? Or, you know, maybe he doesn't want to be in the post because he's sore and he's taking more jump shots, but just his game is totally different. And it's unfortunate. But, again, you hope it changes here in the next few weeks. So
I think it's injury-related, because I think when you're tired, you get tired easily. What do? You end up not playing underneath. You end up playing on the outside. It's a shorter run down the court for defense. You end up shooting more, and that's not what he's best at.
Yeah. So we'll see. But anyway.
Dan,
I was going to run down the conference real quick, because I remember going to practice a few years ago. Zach Spiker was kind enough to let me go take a look. It was around this time of year, a couple weeks left in the season, and they were working on a 1-3-1 zone. This is one of his first 2 years probably here at school. They're working on 1-3-1 to kind of throw in a surprise in the tournament. Like, this is the time of year where they're getting tuned up and they're starting to think about what they're going to deploy in the tournament. And when you look at the conference right now, we're a 7-loss team. Charleston's a 6-loss team. They're 6-6, but they've got the hardest remaining schedule left. I think we're comfortably in front of them. Elon's got 8 losses. They're the next one behind them. And Elon's losing by a million to Hofstra right now. So they're about to go to 9 losses. So this is recorded Tuesday night. So Drexel's pretty comfortably settled into the 4-5 game right now. You know, unless Charleston goes crazy. He's pretty comfortably settled into the 4-5 game, which is great, because you likely avoid Taos and Hofstra as the 2-3 seeds. And I say likely because Wilmington still's got a tough schedule left. You want to play Wilmington if you're Drexel. You want to play Wilmington. You're going to play them. And it'll be interesting, because if you're going to host them, it could be a really tough knockdown, drag it out game. But you want them to get the one seed. So just one of those things that kind of tuck that away in the back of your head. Alan Boston, I spoke to him a few times. He's, like I said, he's very high in the conference. He's feeling a little bit better, which is great. The one thing he noted to me that he said has been proven over year after year after year that he's seen watching college basketball over 30, 35 years. When you lose at home and you're the perceived better team, when a quality team loses at home and gets a revenge game on the road, they tend to be very, very effective. And then they go and win that road follow-up. This is the case at William & Mary this week. So look for the men to go out there. Coming off a loss, Eric. So it's a perfect spot, right? to go out there and kind of throw some weight around against William & Mary on Thursday. I'll be looking for that.
Well, then Saturday, yeah, I mean, a team we blew out once, so you would expect if we don't blow them out the second time in Elon, at least beat them. So, yeah, some consistency again. Can we do something two times in a row, you know, which we haven't been done all year? So
yet another opportunity. So
if Drexel, if Drexel wins the William & Mary game, you know, bet the house that they lose Elon the next game. That would mean going two games over.
It does feel like it.
Yeah.
I got one more note on University of Illinois Chicago. I want to go, but I'm going to leave it for the end of the podcast with Nathan.
No, you know what I was saying. Go for it, because I'll take that. Yeah, do it. We'll get all the men's stuff out of the way, and then we'll go for it.
So yeah, the Horizon League today voted to allow University of Illinois Chicago athletes to play in their respective conference tournaments. This was after they had previously banned them from those conference tournaments because they're transferring out of the league this year. So you hear similar things from the America East teams that are leaving Stony Brook to the CAA, as well as of course James Madison from the CAA to the Sun Belt, and then there's a whole other Conference USA Sun Belt thing going on, where both leagues, I believe, are scheduling Old Dominion and a couple other teams on the schedule for next year, which is fascinating. But concentrating on UIC, and it's easy to go, and I kind of waited for Shane Metlin's tweet from James Madison, and sure enough, it came out, you know, about an hour after the announcement. But you know, complaining about how GMU is still getting stiffed. Long and short answer here, the Horizon press release, if you read it, is pretty hilarious. They crap all over University of Illinois Chicago's administration. So clearly not happy about it, but they're doing what they perceive as right by the students. It's also worth noting the University of Illinois Chicago is not competitive in men's and women's basketball in their two flagship sports this year. So they're letting two teams that basically have no chance of winning the championship into the championship. There's no significant financial stake by the conference in doing it. I think the perception at the time JMU announced the departure was that JMU was going to compete for the league title. By the way, doesn't look like either men or women will be, would have been had they been eligible for the perception back then. So I don't believe, I'm a cynic. I played Wordle yesterday, but I'm a cynic. And I don't believe that this was the goodness of the hearts of the Horizon League. I think the Horizon League saw an opportunity to look good publicly with a very little to risk. And so they went ahead and did it. Do I hope all conferences do it? Should the CAA do it? Yeah. Yeah, it's right about the student athletes. But, you know, there's money on the line, so they're not going to. And we need to be realistic in this, too. So that's my note there. I thought it was a good move by the Horizon. I just don't expect anybody else to follow it, where there's any risk at all for the teams to win and take any money off the table from the rest of the league.
Yeah, I guess I look at it as like it's not our problem as far as, you know, playing in the tournament. So I guess I haven't really thought what I think. I mean, I said this before. I mean, my issue with James Madison is how, you know, they basically sold all their other athletes out for their football team, but then also got to complain in the conference about how they were, ruining their lives and ruining their mental health and on because they couldn't play in the tournament. So they're trying to have it both ways. So that bothered me.
Well, we call that the Ben Simmons defense.
Yeah.
right. I mean, and it is what it is. I won't call it anybody else's mental health because I won't speak towards it, but it doesn't feel right to me.
I
think Jerry Beach was right there. The reason why I keep pounding this, Nate, is because on July 1st, the first day of the next year, I hope the 12 presidents get together in the CAA. Jerry Beach said this last week. I hope they get together, they get in the room, and they expunge the rule because it is wrong by the student athletes. So I hope that we, as a media, or whatever we are, keep beating this drum until July 1st, and then those 12 presidents for the new CAA get in the room and do what's right.
Yeah. I guess the only thing I was thinking, you know, it's been kicked around. Has this affected James Madison in men's and women's basketball? Are they not performing the way that we would? I agree with you. I see you shaking your head. I don't know that it's made. I mean, the men's team had a ton of injuries. And I mean, they don't tend to play defense to begin with. So, and in the women's team, and we'll see them tomorrow night for the first time. I know they had an injury there's a Twin Valley girl that I saw in high school a few times. She got hurt. So, her name is escaping me. I feel bad. So they've had some bad luck. But, you know, I don't know that it's really affected them that much. I don't know what you guys think, but. So yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, it seems like they should still get. Ultimately, sure, let them play. Why not? And let them. Yeah, we don't have to hear them whine. But then again, you know, you see where the coaches,
you know, or the conferences want to keep some stability too. So you kind of see, you know, their end of things, but.
Yeah, but that's not the rule that's stopping anybody from leaving. It's just screwing the students. It's not, if you want to stop a school from leaving, you got to make it a monetary penalty. What the SoCon did this year, doubling the exit fee from $1 million to $2 million, that'll stop a school from leaving. Don't.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Yeah. You know, and these days too, I mean, they're loyal. We're talking about transfers, right? In the way, I mean, there is no loyalty anymore. So whether it's coaches taking off or players taking off. So, but yeah, we'll see how that plays out. So, and add to Eric, you pointed out too, who's leaving. Our old friend from the CAA is leaving their conference too. Tell us about that quick.
Who do you?
Your memory too. You're older than the rest of us, so I don't blame you. But
Old Dominion. Yeah, Old Dominion leaving Conference USA.
Yeah, that's a big deal for me, I feel like. You know.
To the Sun Belt. I believe three teams are leaving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of it's a big deal for me too is to see how it plays out, these schools, not just adding team football as Old Dominion did, but then how does it work out for them, you know, as far as the conference they go into, and is it working out financially? You know, and that's my other thing. It's, you know, ultimately it's like, who cares, you know, unless you're in that top rung in FBS football, it's like, to me, I don't see much of a difference to FCS. I'm sure there's bowls and that sort of thing, but it's really hard to do what Cincinnati did and get into, you know, the playoffs. So there's a ceiling there. But hey, they can knock themselves out going into whatever worthless FBS conference they want, as far as I'm concerned. But and then sacrifice the rest of your student athletes in the process. Just the economics these days, unfortunately. So, but yeah.
It's Marshall, ODU, and Southern Miss all leaving CUSA for the belt.
Wow.
Okay. You know, sure. That Tidewater area, you know, it's the largest market in the United States that doesn't have a professional sports franchise. So, you know, there's a really good, you know, if they do go BCS, I think you're going to, you know, maybe the people in that town, in that area, get behind them.
Yeah, 757, that's a very loyal and passionate, like a lot of Virginia Tech fans come out of that area. So, but yeah, I don't see any sign of Old Dominion becoming, and even Virginia Tech, I mean, they picked up the Penn State defensive coordinators taking over for them. We'll see what happens, but yeah, it's interesting to watch the trajectory of these programs over the years to see whether the decision plays out. ODU basketball has suffered, I think we can say. I mean, I haven't heard a whipper out of them. So, you know.
So, yeah, I wanted to go there and say those schools are Marshall's 2-10, Southern Miss is 1-10, ODU is 5-7, and CUSA this year in basketball. They're all terrible.
Yeah.
This is what happens when you sell out for football.
Yeah.
This is what, and the crazy thing is, and the thing that if I was a JMU fan, I'd be quaking my boots about, is what if the Power Five does split off in football? You end up back in 1AA anyway, essentially.
Yeah, essentially.
And
yeah.
You're selling out your basketball and not really going anywhere for football. I think that could really happen, and JMU could be left holding back pretty bad here.
Yeah. So, hey, but whatever. You know, I love college football, but that's why I'm not renewing my Penn State season tickets. When you work in the organization that pays the head coach $9 million and you feel like you probably have more effect on humanity than he does, it hits different. So yeah, that's a different conversation. So but all right, so you ready to go to the women? I'm gonna talk about
actually have that conversation with you on this podcast because I think it would be a good conversation to have, and it'd be a really good honest conversation to have. Let's go to the women, because
keep it in mind. So that's a great point for the women that this weekend. So it's Friday night, they went up to Hofstra. This was a close game in really through three quarters. Again, you look at the stat lines, it was pretty even. I mean, Hofstra wouldn't go away. But then just kind of went in two completely different directions. We finished on a 19-4 run in the last 7 minutes, 20 seconds. And then Hofstra shot 1-for-7 down the stretch. So they just kind of fell apart. You know, we got our usual games from Keyshawn Washington, who had 21 points with 14 in the second half. By the way, she'll do that in the first half every now and then too. But she had a big second half. And then Hannah Nihill, the big game. She had 12 points in the second half too. Hofstra went 1 for their last 7 from field goals, but they were 4 of 14 for the fourth quarter. So that was really the difference. Mara Hendrickson too, I thought had a nice game as kind of a spark plug. She only had 2 threes, but then had 8 rebounds.
And those are the type of role players that if we get them to do really much of anything on top of what Brugler, Nihil, and Washington do, this becomes a much better team and got us just enough three-pointers and made a difference for us. So game we expected to win, had to have, we took care of business, so it was good. And then game I was probably most nervous about over the weekend was going up to Northeastern. And, you know, because they always play us tough, including this year down at the DAC. But we ended up winning 61-46. I mean, I was saying this, I think I said this on the message board. It was like, it's about time we didn't get the best shot from teams. You know, Hofstra in the fourth quarter didn't play their best. Northeastern was awful in this game, and they shot terrible. We kind of stretched the lead out in the second quarter. They were 1 of 11 in the second quarter and 29% in the first half. We actually weren't a whole lot better because we were 4 of 15 in the second quarter. But when one team can't make anything and you just make a couple baskets, that makes a big difference. You know, they made maybe one run in the fourth quarter, but really nothing serious to get back in the game. We forced seven more turnovers to them, outscored them by 14 in points off turnovers. So then we got inside on them too, outscored them by 20 in the paint. A kind of a player I think that stood out this weekend was Valentine. She had 13 rebounds on Sunday. So, you know, again, another player you see isn't quite polished yet, but she's got size, which we haven't had in our program compared to some other players. And, you know, we need somebody to go in there and show some toughness and get some rebounds. She's been doing that for us too, especially this weekend. So, so bottom line, you know, it was nice to have two, especially the fourth quarter, to really have a little bit of an easy game on Sunday, headed into, you know, it's a really big week. So you said, you know, James Madison on Wednesday, we get through that. It's for all the marbles on Sunday, essentially down in Delaware. So if anybody has the opportunity to go to that game, strongly recommend it. I have this idea to try to get Joe Biden to go, and then I'll buy him dinner at the Japanese restaurant in Newark, which, by the way, is my favorite restaurant anywhere. You know, everybody hates Delaware, but it's about the best Japanese food that you're going to have anywhere. So looking forward to being down there on Sunday. So, any thoughts you guys had on the women through the weekend?
Well, not really. My thoughts are about Japanese food, and I'm stunned by this. I've eaten down there a lot. I'd never have been there.
It's called Ramen Kumamoto, and it's terrific ramen, tonkatsu. And it's not like, you know, hibachi is like American, sort of like, you know, sweet and sour chicken is American Chinese food. But it's legit. I mean, you guys get a chance. It's wonderful. So
I'm in for it, because I always feel like we have a terrible eating experience or end up at Iron Hill whenever we're down there. But yeah,
not too expensive either. You know, yeah, so sushi is too damn expensive here in the U.S. too. But any thoughts you guys had about
the city of Newark? It's just endless. You know, the amount of choices. It's unbelievable.
It says on the door when you walk in, it's like number one rated. I think it says either Asian or Japanese food, and I think it's all of Delaware. And on one hand, you're like, wow, that's impressive. But then again, you're like, what's the competition like? But
yeah,
even if it had good competition, I feel like it would win. There's a place by the DAC that we've gone to a couple times, and that's pretty good too, like the ramen shop.
It's not bad. Yeah, I like that spot.
They're good too, but this place, yeah, it's like my favorite place to eat. So we don't get down there. I was pissed when they changed the men's game to a Tuesday, Thursday night. It started at like 6. You asked me if I was going. I'm like, I can't. It's like a 6 o'clock start. So, and it was supposed to be a Saturday, and we were like, yeah, we're going to go to Ramen Kumamoto after the game. Missed out, but we will definitely, no snow in the forecast, so I think we will definitely be there. So, but I did want to touch on it. So to me, I think the big story was Denise Dillon taking the Villanova Wildcats women's team into UConn. And I know, you know, UConn is, you know, their best player, Paige Brockers, I think I'm saying her name right. She's been out for a while, and then they had a player, their center didn't play, and then someone else was like a late scratch. So UConn was very shorthanded, but UConn's still UConn and hadn't lost a home or a conference game period in like 9 years. Stretch of like 170 games or something like that. So that's a tough out. Similar, you think back to when she knocked off Old Dominion in the CAA tournament. Villanova went up there and won that game.
And then we went, it's been on my list of things to do, just like eating at Ramen Kumamoto this year. But to go see, you know, Denise Dillon coach Villanova. So we went Friday night, and you know, that game was almost as important, about more important for Villanova standings purposes, because Marquette, I think, was tied with them. I think they're both like 11-3 in conference. And I won't go into the nitty gritty of the game, but basically it's one of those kind of a rock fight kind of game. And, you know, Marquette held like 3 to 7 points the whole game, couldn't put Villanova away, but Villanova couldn't go on a run. But then in the last minute, you know, out of nowhere, Villanova put some good possessions together. Marquette started to turn the ball over, forced overtime, and then Villanova just kind of pulled away in overtime. So so that was a huge win for Coach Dillon too. So really neat. I know Dan for sure, and well, Eric, of course, you know, we've all been around her entire coaching career in some ways. So really in the last week, we've seen her take a step to almost the top of women's basketball. So I'm going to say what you want with UConn and shorthanded and stuff, but hey, win's a win. And so really neat to see that. So I don't know if you guys, what do you guys think about what's going on over there?
Well, that was her dream to go back to Villanova. And she's kicking butt. She's, you know, she's doing Drexel proud over there.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to find you'll find bigger fans than me, because there are some people who are who know her personally. But I tell you, I mean, she just did everything the right way here. I mean, just, and she stuck it out. She waited for the Nova job. Everybody knew she was waiting for the Nova job. I don't think there's really any question what was going to happen last offseason. But man, what a pleasure of a person. What a person who assembles a program the right way. I had a great time. I think I may have mentioned this on a before podcast, and I do apologize, but when she got her 300 wins at Drexel, I got quotes from a bunch of former players and stuff. And the guys I got on the phone, actually accidentally, but Mike Connors and Bruiser, you know, hearing them talk about their relationship with her and what she did and how special it was. You know, when you have peers who've known each other for that amount of time, worked together in the same building for that amount of time, who speak about you like that, it's pretty clear, you know, that this person is legit, not just as a person or as a basketball coach, not just as a basketball coach, but as a person. So it's pretty cool to be able to root for her. And as much as it pains me to pull for Nova, you know, I'm going to pull for Denise Dillon, you know, wherever she goes, because it's, I think she left a legacy here, to be honest with you, with Amy Mallon, with what's going on right now. Mm-hmm. I think we should still be thanking her. I'd love to at some point get to know her better, because it's just she strikes you as a special person. Mm-hmm. Thrilled to see what she's doing, Nova.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric. Where you? Yeah,
they got two quality. I mean, the way that program's run over there between the men and the women, two of the classiest coaches you'll ever meet, and you know they're very, very successful.
Yeah. Now the best thing she did do is left us Amy Mallon. That's another reason why it doesn't pay me to root for her, because both programs were successful. It's just neat. We're really lucky to tap into sort of that coaching tree as we went along. So, and as much as it pains me to root for Villanova, and now I'm in too on the men's team. They're playing Providence right now, and that's their big game. So I may take a look at that. But yeah, I was listening to the men's radio broadcast, the Seton Hall game, and we were driving out for the Drexel game. And I think finally at like the second media timeout in their pregame show, they mentioned the women's team, and it's like, where is that? I don't know. It's how I think, but I mean, where is that in your pregame show? Unless I missed it, you know, but I guess when you're that spoiled and you've won that many national titles, I mean, it still blows me away walking into the lobby there and seeing two national titles sit there. But you know, Jay Wright, get her on your podcast. I was looking, there's gotta be somebody from Villanova that had her on their podcast this week, and I didn't see her name come up anywhere. So yeah, Villanova guy's got to get with the program and give her her spotlight, because she deserves it. And I hope those fans support what she's doing. It was a pretty good crowd there. And one last point, it was also team autograph night. So it was another draw for, you know, to have my kids. They have an autograph poster of a team that beat Villanova. But I printed out photos, and we tracked Coach Dillon down after the game. And I think that's what I said to her. I'm like, you got me rooting for Villanova. You should be proud, or something like that. And yeah, I took the time, signed autographs for my kids, and you know, and just a class act.
Did you wear your Drexel gear there?
I did. Yeah, I wore a Drexel hoodie for sure. Kids didn't, but yeah, no, and last point I want to make, by the way, the athletic department did make right, I thought, on the promotion. You know, really got good communication from Jill Axel, and then and I hope I say her name right, Miesha Kelly. You know, we were standing in line on Saturday to meet the men's team, and she came up and you know, introduced herself and everything. And part of that is I donated some money, not a lot of money. I guess I don't know what a lot of money is for donations. I'm not going to name it Nate Hemmerly Court, that's for sure. But I wanted to give some positive reinforcement that, you know, when you communicate well and, you know, you reach out and you're not defensive, that's going to keep people coming. And the men's autograph session went really well. I haven't looked at them yet, but yeah, the women's team ended up signing the photos for us. So we have those. So everybody did a nice job. And I just made the point, I want this stuff to work for us. I want people to be proud of, and we want Phil, you know, the Villanova, and I know it's Villanova, don't get me wrong, but we waited, I think, an hour, hour and a half to meet the women's team over there, a ton of kids. So it's like, I know we're never going to get that. I know, but in my wildest dreams, you know, at least maybe get, you know, a decent crowd where people know of a promotion, it goes well, and then they want to come back and they want to see more games. That's what I want to see. So,
yeah, so, yeah. Definitely time for another podcast on that one. But I do know that there was also a gentleman on the Dragons Cast Slack channel that had an issue getting a response from the ticket office this past week. And he said that one was able to get cleared up. And actually named Jill Axel as well as somebody who helped him out. So I'm glad to hear that when they see problems, you know, or when it's addressed to them, they're following up, which is good. You know, that's the first step. But, you know, he made a mark on the channel that it was good to have connections. And I was like, there's like 30 season ticket holders in your office. Like, if you don't feel like you have a connection, like, they should make every season ticket holder feel loved. There's no reason you've got, whatever it is, 12 home games. You got to touch three people a game. Mm-hmm. Three people a game, really, to cover your whole season ticket holder base. You have the time. You have the time to make sure these people have love. You have the time to walk up to them and say, hey, here's some guest tickets for next week. You have some time, right, to go out there and build that relationship and hear what they think the problems are, whatever else, you know, and listen and respond to them and show them you're responding. So I want to see a whole lot more, but it's good to hear that at least where the ship is leaking, you know, they're trying to plug the holes, put it that way. I'm really happy you got a positive response, Nate.
Hey, but they must listen to this podcast. I mean, that's what we're here for. Hey,
the Villanova fans, who needs to listen to this podcast? Because if they don't have Denise Dillon on, we are inviting her on the show. I'm going to have her, and I'm going to have Amy Mallon, and we'll invite them. We'll get turned down, but we will invite them. We might not get turned down. Who knows?
Yeah. And Jill, by the way, Jill Axel, she offered me tickets too. Yeah, they did everything right. I mean, I paid anyway. Like, no, I mean, the point to this is I want to support Drexel basketball. Like, I don't want to be turned off. So I'm like, no, we're getting our own tickets. But they did everything right. So I was thrilled with how that went. And I think it all comes down, we all want to see this succeed. We all want to see this grow. You know, I was talking to JB, and he was like, you know, he was saying, well, Villanova has that fan base, you know, in the suburbs, and then maybe Temple is more the city, but we're not going to build anywhere if we don't have successful promotions and things like that. So so nice to see it. But
hey, yeah, I just saw that the coaches poll came out. Drexel women got 7 votes. And they're now,
yeah.
I guess if you do the math, they're 32nd, according to that poll, they're 32nd in the country.
And Sunday is for all the marbles. So if you have not watched a women's basketball game all year, please do it. It's Eric, I don't know, it's probably on TV. I don't know if it, I would imagine Comcast, because they picked up a couple of the Delaware games. So if for either reason, I would hope it's on TV. But I mean, it's going to be a war, and it's going to be fun to watch. So
what time's the game on Sunday?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock Sunday. It is not on TV. It is on Flow Sports. Right. The William and Mary game the following Friday will be on TV.
I'm able to make that one. Have to be somewhere 4:30, but might be.
That's a shame, because that's going to be, you know. And again, you know, it's fun when we've got, you know, Keyshawn against Jasmine Dickey. I mean, you got it's. I mean, I'm telling you guys, this is fun to watch. So, but hey, whatever.
You know, let me just double check that, because I want to. I was looking at our webpage, and sometimes we don't have the guests or the road. It is going to be on TV. It's just not noted on our website.
Okay.
So on Delaware's website, you can see it's on NBC Sports Philadelphia.
Okay, yeah, so, I figured it needs to be. So, and it's an important game. I mean, getting that one seed, you know, and avoiding Towson and that two. I mean, there's going to be, you know, whether we play Northeastern, we could see Charleston again. I mean, those aren't going to be walks in the park either. But, you know, to get yourself out of, you know, a Towson matchup in this, and then, you know, and we play them in the last game of the regular season on a Saturday. That's a big game too. But But this gives somebody the inside track to the championship. So, yeah, huge can't game. Say yeah how big it is. So
I mean, Drexel essentially clinches if they win this thing. I mean, they'd have a two game, they'd have a game lead, game and a half lead with a tiebreaker, mm-hmm. with not a lot of games to play. So it's a huge, huge, huge game.
Yeah,
no doubt about it.
So we'll see. But all right, anything else you guys want to talk about?
I'm hoping I'll draft. We're hoping for a surprise guest on the next podcast. So look forward to that. We got some conversation going back and forth there. So excited to hear that. Also, we'll bring this up in the future, but I recommend that anybody who listens to this podcast listens to February 14th's Consider This from NPR podcast. You'll recognize a guest on that podcast. And it's something I actually really, really want to talk about. The conversation there is a great conversation for us. So we'll bring that up in the future, maybe even after the season's over, but it'll come up.
I have it saved on my to-listen list on the Apple app, which kind of sucks, but it is there. So yes, I keep that in mind. So
there's one word for that interview, and it's irony.
I'm excited. All right.
All right.
Well, thank you for being here. Have a good night.
Have a good night, everybody.